As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Keith Law Show, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. This is episode 63 of the Keith Law Show. I am Keith Law. My guest today will be Will Leach, a second time or the first time I will have had a repeat guest on this podcast. I was hoping to go about 10 years before I had to do that, but no, Will had to go and write a great novel called How Lucky, which I just finished the other day and immediately texted Will and said, your novel's great, come back on the show and let's talk about it. For subscribers to The Athletic, I will have a new post coming up, a longer piece coming up this week about colleges that have dropped baseball, Division I programs that have dropped baseball, both those during the pandemic and some major athletic schools that dropped it a long time ago and have chosen not to bring it back. You can also find my first mock draft, which came out not quite 2 weeks ago. I will have another one coming up soon towards the end of the month, with the draft coming up on July 11th. That will be held in Denver. I will be there in person. It's after the Futures game. So I will be at the Futures game and then I will be at the draft myself. While we're also talking books, I would love to remind everyone that my second book, The Inside Game, Bad Calls, Strange Moves, and What Baseball Behavior Teaches Us About Ourselves, is out now in paperback. It came out in April. And if you're looking for gifts with Father's Day coming up, check out that book or my first book, Smart Baseball, which is also available in paperback for the baseball fan in your life. Now it is my pleasure to welcome back my first repeat guest. I believe in all the many years that I've been doing the Keith Law Show, not even a year and a half, Will Leach is the first person to be a guest twice on the show. If you don't remember Will from last time, he writes lots of words. He writes for MLB, he writes New York Magazine. He does a great film podcast with his longtime friend, my friend as well, Tim Grierson. Will has occasionally done his own podcast called People Still Read Books. But the reason Will is here today is because he wrote a novel, How Lucky, which came out 5 weeks ago-ish.
May 11th. Like, literally a month ago today.
Tip on the day we're recording it, which came out through HarperCollins, which, full disclosure, HarperCollins also published both of my books. However, I actually read the book, and it's awesome. And I said to Will, I want you to come on my show and talk about it. So Will, that was a very long introduction. Will, thank you for staying here for the long introduction. Thank you for joining the show.
I am honored to be here to be your first ever second guest. Once I saw that Grierson was on, I thought, okay, I need something to one up Grierson. So being on twice now is my way to be able to do
it. Excellent.
Well, thank you for having me. And I, you know, Keith, I listen to this show all the time, and one of the many things that I like about the show is your variety of guests from all sorts of different angles of the world. And now I'm glad that you'll have smart people and not smart people like me.
Tim is the smart people, and you're the other.
Well,
is that what
I didn't say Tim specifically, but
So for folks who haven't read the book, I have a whole review up on my own site, which is meadowparty.com. But the part that really stood out to me that I loved so much about the book is that you have this incredible main character in the book. Although there's a Rear Window-esque mystery I keep wanting to say the woman in the, what was the, how much is that woman in the window? Yeah, the movie from a couple weeks ago, which thank, there was no chance I was going to watch that anyway. But after your review of it, I was like, okay, good. I've saved myself the trouble. Yeah, there's a good mystery at the heart of it, but this is really about Daniel. So I would love to, for you to start by talking about, where did Daniel come from? Where did he first pop into your mind, or how did you come about creating this really just fun, insightful, interesting character?
Yeah, so Daniel started out, you know, in the knowledge of the book, I talk about how you know, my son's best friend's name is Miller. My wife's best friend, one of her closest friends, is named Eason, and they've known each other since they were like 3 years old. And so Eason and her wife had a son. They had a donor for their son. And they were the same age as William. So we were very excited that they would be best friends the way that Eason and my wife were best friends. And so they were like, really, they were very, very close. And then we kind of noticed that they were playing together one day. This is a scene that is literally replicated in the book, where they were playing together one day, and my son was able to kind of carry weight on his legs, and Miller was not. And it turned out that Miller had a disease called spinal muscular atrophy, which, a very shorthand version, I think I literally say in the book, it is shorthand, it is not one-to-one ratio, is the best way to think about SMA. This is a little bit like ALS, but for little kids. It's diagnosed at birth. It's a very, very brutal disease. It's gotten better in the last few years because of a drug called Spinraza, which is a little late for Daniel in this book, but certainly has helped Miller and it helped a lot of other kids. But I, you know, spent a lot of time with Miller and saw his friendship with my son. And I know there used to be a race called the Go Miller Go race that they would do in Charleston, South Carolina every year. And I would always go, and all these people with SMA there. And it was really remarkable to me that at this event, where, you know, people are there to raise awareness of SMA, you know, and to help people with SMA. And SMA is a disease that affects your body, but not your mind in any way, shape, or form. But people just can't help it. So like people treat people with SMA and people with that kind of severe disabilities, they treat them differently. They talk to them in this kind of infantile sort of way. And I found it frustrating. And I know Miller found it frustrating. And I talked to some other people that found it very frustrating. So I got in my mind this idea of like, I want to like bring that voice out somehow. And so I thought about it, and I talked to a bunch of people with SMA to get it right and family with SMA. And I just kind of, and one of the things about Daniel I thought would be interesting would be to give him a job that requires him to communicate solely online. And Keith, you and I have been online for a very long time. Too long and too much. And it's not abating to any stretch of the imagination. And I kind of like the idea that Daniel, you know, Daniel has this line at the beginning of the book where he talks about like, one of the things I love about being online is no one knows they're supposed to be nice to me.
It's one of the better things, like the better conceit is that people are, because he has a very visible disability, people are just automatically nice to him out of guilt or pity or something.
And he hates that more than he would hate if someone just called him an asshole.
Online all the time.
Exactly. So basically, like, I wanted Daniel. One of the things I found from the number of people I talk, and listen, I'm an able-bodied person. And so by definition, I cannot know what it's like to have SMA or really any disability in that way as well as someone. Again, I recognize that that weakness from the beginning and the inherent ceiling to what I can understand. So for me, I kind of took a journalistic attitude to just figure out as much as I could about the disease and talk to as many people. And the one thing I generally found across the board was people who, you know, have obviously, like, there's tons of things that they're unable to do that we take for granted. People that are not do not have disabilities take for granted on a regular basis. And the number of people I find who like will complain about like the most banal things walking around their day. There's a negativity in the world that I think I find from a lot of people I've spoken to that have SMA and really a lot of disabilities they don't have. Like there's a certain understanding of you know what, I've got limitations, but like, isn't life great? Isn't life awesome? And I find that my favorite people are like that, whether they have or they don't, are people that understand that like life is, the world is a good place and you're trying to, you do the best with it without whatever problems they have. And so I wanted to have a character who had a very optimistic attitude about the planet despite a very difficult situation. And then I figured, okay, well now, once I figured out Daniel, kind of figured out his voice, then I had to find something for him to do.
Right.
So I had to find something for him to do. I can't just have him just sit in his room and correspond with people online all day. And so I will confess, initially the idea of the thriller aspect, it's weird. And I said, I was on John Heilman's podcast talking about this, and I, you know, I read books. I read a lot of books, but for me, you know, the fun of books is, you know, a book can be anything. Like, you can just fill it with all these words mm-hmm. and bring it to all these different places you want to go. And so it seems very strange to me that you would be like, oh, well, this book is a thriller. This book is contemporary fiction. This book is historical fiction. Like, for me, it struck me as very strange. I'm like, I'm just going to, like, let the book do what it's going to do, because I don't have, like, $80 million of 20th Century Fox's money that I have to, like, make a product. Like, I can make the book whatever I want it to be.
And the appearance really of the superhero in the second half was, yeah. I had some questions about that.
It was just weird. You know, it reminded me, the reason I say it is there's a lot of, like, expectations people have when they hear the word thriller.
Right.
That it's going to, like, follow this sort of thing. It reminds me why I don't like sports movies. This is my dirty secret about sports movies. I don't like sports movies because I love sports and I love movies. But the reason I love both of those things is because I don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
I get to be surprised what's happening. But for some reason, we've decided to make sports movies have this very clear, obvious and dumb arc that happens in every single bad sports movie, and so I tend to not like sports movies. It seems so limiting. And so for me, like, the idea that, like, I just don't read enough thrillers to, like, know what the conventions are of it. So I just kind of wrote the story, and then I figured, like, the thriller could be a propulsive story. It's based on something that happened at the University of Illinois, yep. where I went to school a few years ago. It's kind of inspired by that story. So but mainly, you know, I think the story really is about Daniel and about how he sees the world and his embrace of the world in a way that I hopefully will stick with people and resonate with people, because, you know, Daniel is not me. Daniel is friendlier and nicer and I think generally more, I wouldn't say more hopeful, but I would say Daniel doesn't get down. Right. And I think, like everybody else, I get down sometimes. But Daniel has, like, a very, like, he greets the world in a way that I think I wish I was able to do a little bit. And I think that helps. But he's a well-rounded guy. You know, I think there is a certain kind of notion when people see, like, oh, this is about someone with a disability, that there's going to be, like, this pathos or this, like, or I can get him too. And I think Daniel has, like, a very, like, clear-eyed understanding of who he is and what his place in the world is. I think hopefully is appealing for people to read.
So I'll get back to Daniel in a moment, but something you just said too, talking about, you said you don't read a lot of thrillers, but you do watch a lot of them. You watch a lot of movies. And yeah. I'm curious, did any of that, you know, I mentioned Rear Window, which is an old film by Alfred Hitchcock. You may not be familiar with that, but did you think of the book at all in terms of a movie? Do you envision, like, I know you've written a YA novel before, but this was your first novel for adults. I was going to say adult novel. That could mean something slightly different. Did you think of it that way? Did you envision it that way? Not like in terms of this is going to be filmed and Zack Snyder is going to do the supercut of How Lucky.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
because those do, the psychological thrillers, do in even in cinema do have conventions. That's actually one of the reasons I almost never watch. Like, I'm very reluctant to go see a lot of those because I want to wait and make sure, is this just another one of the, you know, I've seen these 50 times. I've seen a lot of Hitchcock movies, right?
You can't surprise
me with most of that stuff. So did that come in, your knowledge so much and experience watching thriller films help inform how you crafted that portion of the book?
I would say that I wanted the best parts of me. My favorite suspense movies are movies that met out the suspense judiciously.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's going back to the sports movie idea. Like, my favorite sports movie of all time is Bull Durham.
Yep.
And the reason for that is it gets the baseball right. That's one of the best things about the movies. It gets the baseball right. But it's not about the baseball.
It's not a baseball. Right. I've argued this with people. Yeah.
And that's why it's great. Like, it gets the baseball stuff right. If it screwed up all the baseball stuff, then it would not be as great of a movie that it is.
Right.
But it uses baseball to tell a larger thing. And so for me, I wanted, like, the larger story is Daniel and his view of the world and how hopefully it can mean something to people. And I think kind of speak to people at this specific time. But, like, so for me, the thriller thing, it seems weird to me. I'll put it this way. Write a thriller but not have the character stuff in there, then what's the point? Like I want to write about people, you know?
Right.
And like, it's funny how I'm already working on the next book, and which has been very nice. This is How Lucky has done well enough that they're going to let me do another one. And I find it so strange. And maybe because I don't know. I said this to my editor. I said, maybe the only reason because I've seen reviews be like, wow, this really subverts the thriller. And I'm like, yes, that was something I did on purpose, was subvert the thriller conventions, because I'm so familiar with all of them. And I just don't, you know, I don't understand the point of just writing a book. There's nothing wrong with it when people do this book, but I don't see the point of just being like, oh, I'm just gonna have a thing with a lot of twists and turns, and like, yeah, that's fine, you can do that, but like, the point is the people. Why would you write a book about people and not have it be people that everybody care about, can relate, and do? So the times that the thriller aspect, you want it to be propulsive, and you want to mm-hmm. make sure that people keep feel compelled to continue reading. Because the book is, particularly for like the first half or even first two thirds, there's a lot of backstory. Like, there's a lot of like character work and character backstory. And I want the thriller makes sure, hopefully, that people stick with that and are willing to go through that. This book, if it were just the thriller, would A, not be very long. Right. and B, would seem entirely empty to me. And so I wanted to use a thriller in the same way that, frankly, I think Hitchcock, if to me, the Rear Window aspect, I mean, obviously there's a superficial similarity, but the thing I love about Hitchcock is he will use aspects of the thriller to tell the story he really wants to tell. Like, Rear Window is not about some guy watching some crime getting committed. It's about surveillance.
Yep.
And it's about like human weakness. Like, one of the great things about that movie is how bored he is with like the most beautiful, perfect woman in the world.
Right.
and just how, and how like there's this guy that like is so caught up in like being this incredible guy that he can't see that what's right in front of his face, even though he's literally, his job is to be able to take photos of things. Mm-hmm. And so like that is, to me, is what Rear Window is about. There is obviously, Rear Window is a great thriller, but what it really is, it's a story about like Vertigo is a great thriller, but it's really a movie about obsession. And like, that's my favorite thing about Hitchcock, is he's so good at making thrillers that he can put all this stuff in there that people just absorb, but maybe don't like realize that's actually what he's trying to do. And so, for me, I felt comfortable. And listen, not everyone's going to feel this way. If you're one of those people that just wants just get me to A to B to C to D to E and plot points in this book, and then let's get through. There are detours and there are things that go off in that. But to me, the thriller aspect was a means to an end rather than and hopefully the thriller works, but it was a means to an end rather than the, I really wanted to write it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it works. I mentioned in my own review too, you kind of have an idea where we're going to end up. You just don't know exactly how we're going to get there, but that's not the point. The point was, to me, this is why the thriller is effective, even though, as you said, it's a fairly small part of the book. I mean, if you didn't have Daniel, this would be a James Patterson book, right? It would be this long. People can't see, my fingers are very close together here. The chapters would each be a page and a half, maybe less, and you would never remember the name of any of the characters,
And it wouldn't have been very fun to write, to be honest.
No,
for me,
I don't want to. I don't want to write a book. I've never actually written or published a novel, but I don't want to write that. Like, I would love to write a novel someday. Not that one. Not that kind.
And there's nothing wrong with that stuff. Like, I really don't. But like, you know, to me, you know, some people have said like the book really feels like it uses the thriller as like a Daniel delivery device, and that is exactly, I do not deny that fact. Yep. Like, I get it. Hopefully the thriller works. Like, I really do. I really hope the thriller works, and I certainly hope that it keeps the page turning and keeps you excited about what's going on. But this is a Daniel, like, Daniel is the book, and his view of the world and who he is and his friendships and the people he has along the way. And so, maybe this is why if I read more thrillers, I would know to like, oh no, you need less Daniel and more, like, you know, not for nothing, but like with the production of this book, you know, I originally did not, like, this was not like, a publisher did not come to me and say, "Will, write us a thriller." I basically wrote it in my spare time and handed it to my agent, physically printed it out and handed it to my agent like a schmuck from like a 90s movie who like left it in the cab or something. and so he went to go sell it, and people liked it, but they were all like, "Yeah, but like, maybe Marjani should be in on it." You know, like that, like they wanted like these, like that sort of stuff.
A twist.
Like, yeah. Yeah, and I'm just, I'm not doing that book. And this is fine. If people want that, they can find those books. Right. But for me, I felt like that if I changed it that much, it's not the book I wanted to write.
Right. That's, to me, that, God, if Mark Johnny had been in on it, I would have been so mad at you, actually.
Oh, my God. I mean, like, what would have been the point of, like, again, if I were going to do that, then I wouldn't have gone through the trouble of made all these characters
right.
in the
that's
first
right.
place.
Well, that's just what I was going to say, was my next question was already going to be, before we return to Daniel, but... So Marjani and Travis, the two main secondary characters. I mean, see, they're the two secondary characters who get a real three-dimensional treatment, too.
Yeah.
That is the other reason this book really works for me, because it's also – it's not The Martian, which is a friend of mine because I just read it a couple of months ago. Where
which is really good.
Which is really good. Yeah. So good, I gave that to my brother-in-law for his birthday a couple weeks ago, and he ripped through it. He made a point. I just saw him this weekend, and he said, oh, my God, I love that book. I couldn't put it down. And he was pointing out sort of – we were talking about reasons why that works. But it's one guy. That is one character. You don't really – there are other characters appear, but they don't get fleshed out. This is not that. Daniel, I think, one, needs a couple of foils to work against to create some contrast, a little more texture to his personality. And also, it's just – a little more interesting. He is a person who does not speak. He has to, you know, does so with a speech assistance device. But he does communicate with people. And you also have him communicating almost in this, it's nonverbal communication with these two people who are extremely close to him, where a little wink or a nod, a facial expression can convey a lot more. And to me, that not only tells us more about Daniel's character, but I thought just gave more, I'm going to use the word again, texture to the book. That's, oh no, here are two also very real people who are within Daniel's orbit. And each of them is very interesting in their own right. Maybe not strong enough to be a protagonist, but really, really strong secondary characters.
Yeah, you know, I wanted a couple of things. That one, you know, Travis, who is his best friend and is kind of a I watched a Sideways for the podcast this week. And we're talking about, and like, there is definitely a little bit of Thomas Hayden Church's character. He's not much of a jerk as that character is,
no.
but he's definitely
Travis is kind at heart.
Yeah, he's very kind. He's also, you know, he smokes a lot of weed. He makes a lot of dumb decisions. You know, he truly deeply loves Daniel in the way that like true friends love each other, and I, you know, to me, a lot of that obviously comes out from my son. You know, I'm hoping that's the sort of friend he'll be able to be for Miller as they're older. But also, I think that Marjani in particular, you know, she's basically his paid caretaker, and that relationship is a fascinating one. My mother is a retired ER nurse for 40 years, and I've spent a lot of time in hospitals, a lot of time with caregivers. And there is a certain line that they always have to be careful of balancing, of the idea of I am here to help this person and to take care of this person and be close to this person and they need me, but I am also paid to do so, and I have to therefore keep a certain amount of distance to hold myself together. And you see Marjani kind of struggle with that a little bit as the book goes along, and how that kind of cracks a little bit. And she's got her own backstory and her own story kind of going on. But the thing they all have in common is they are, you know, they're kind. Yeah. Like, they're kind people, and I don't, but they're not, you know, they're not, I would not classify them inherently heroic or particularly like unique and, you know, and unusually, you know, special in how they're so much better than the average person. They're just regular, everyday, normal people who do nice things for people, because everyday normal people do nice things for people all the time. And I think that that gets lost in the way that we interact with the world, in the way that we consume information about our world. One of the things that Daniel talks about at the beginning of the book is that, like, he's like, you know what? No one ever tweets about, like, someone held the door open for me today. Hashtag blessed, isn't humanity great? You know, And you know, one of the things that's it's a way, you know, part of the book is about communication, and it reminds me a little bit how it bleeds, it leads idea of news, right? This is what media people always get accused of, the idea like you're never going to lead the evening news with, in the 80s is a big criticism, like no one leads the evening news with our lead story tonight. Everything is pretty much the same that it was yesterday, and everything's all right.
Things are good.
And don't worry. It's going to be okay. You're going to live a long, happy life, and you're going to have people who love you. And like this, that's not news. Anyone would do that. But what's interesting now is because everyone is basically their own kind of news organ, and like everyone is constantly blasting this out. Everyone is doing the media thing now. Everyone, it's the negative thing. It's the bad thing that hit. Like nobody tweets, someone opened the door for me today. Like nobody does that. And I don't, but and so what Daniel, I think, kind of believes, I think Marjani and Daniel, Marjani and Travis kind of represent, in a certain way, is the idea that like there is just natural goodness and kindness that happens every single day in all of our lives if we would just look at it. If we would just look at it and not get caught up in all the understandably and in fact quite bad things that are going on in the world. So you know, that is the thing that I think the three of them specifically share, is they're just good people and that want to help people and the people that they love. And I think that's very, very common and not documented that often.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
So one of the things, as I've mentioned the book to a few people, including when the book showed up, I mentioned to my wife I was going to be reading it. And obviously, you've met her too. And she said, oh, tell me about it. Give me a quick description. And as I described it, she said, that's interesting that he chose a character with a pretty major disability. How did he go about it's essentially representation, right? You are writing about somebody who doesn't look like you. And I know, because you mentioned a bit in the acknowledgments too, but would love to hear you kind of explain, especially for folks listening, because obviously the whole point here is to sell your book. So how did you go about that, right? You, like me, are an able-bodied white guy. How did you go about putting this on the page, putting this character and this disease on the page in a way that was respectful to and representative of the people who really do have this?
Well, there were a few different tiers for it. And first off, was starting with the idea that while I am glad that there is I've had people with disabilities who have read it and said, it's so nice to have representation. And I agree. But like, I did not go into it with that. Like, I went to write about Daniel.
Right.
And so, you know, Daniel has this, but Daniel is not defined by this. And Daniel, I would argue in the book, is very clearly quite defiant.
Doesn't
about
want
being,
to be. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Defined by that. While still not being like, see, no big deal. Like, he right. clearly understands the limitations that he has. So before I really sat down to start writing, to me, that was just, you know, I talked to Miller's parents, Easton and Lindsay, a bunch. They set me up with a bunch of people to talk to. I've worked with Cure SMA, which is the primary SMA charity. I'm actually doing an event with them in a couple of weeks.
Oh, nice.
But that's the first part, which is to say I can interview them and then I can try to get the little details right. There's little details that are straight out of conversations that I have a lot of people with SMA, including the idea that like it's a progressive disease. So if you like forget how to do something or you lose the ability to do something, it does not come back.
Yeah.
Like it just like, and the practical like daily thing. Like I talked to one woman. She said, yeah, I used to be able to feed myself, and then I had this boyfriend who would do it for me, and then we broke up, and then I couldn't do it anymore. And like, and it's just like practical stuff yeah. like that, that she was not like, woe is me. She just like, yep, that's just one of those things you gotta be vigilant about, because if you're not vigilant about it, it's gonna go away. And like, and to me, that was like really interesting. So then you write it, and you try to put it in the character's voice and make it make sense. But I've had people that have read the book and people that are disabled that were not part of that process. And we're not part of the process I'm about to explain. Mm-hmm. And that read that was out now. And they're like, every time I read a book about someone who's disabled, written by someone who's not disabled, I sit back and go, okay, Okay, let's see where they fuck. Let's see where they fuck. Which is totally reasonable. Sure. Yes. Which is totally reasonable. And they said, we've been kind of surprised that it doesn't really seem to happen in your book. And I said, I know, but that's not a magic trick. That was me showing it to a bunch of people after I'd written it, saying, okay, tell me where I fucked up. And they said, oh, here, and here.
Yep.
And we fixed it.
Yep.
and I can't, it's not perfect. And listen, Daniel is not representative of everyone who has SMA. Most people with SMA are able to speak. Like that is something that Daniel has that I would say the majority, not all, but the majority of people who have SMA at his age are physically able to speak. Mm-hmm. So that like, and some people can't because it's a different right. disease that affects
and there's multiple
in different ways.
Kinds too, which you explain in the book, which I appreciate. Because I would have gone to Google, right? I would have been I got my MD at Google University.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And I would, okay, that, what is that, this?
Yeah, that's how my wife is constantly figuring out what's wrong with her.
Right, yes, exactly.
So I get it. And but for me, like that is, you know, I need, like, he's not representative of everyone with SMA. But he is representative of Daniel, and the details hopefully are right. You know, they're as right as I can get them. And that is I've had a lot of people ask, like, the difference between writing nonfiction and fiction. And, to me, that's where the journalism comes in. Like, that's where I gotta get that right because, you know, it's the same way that when you watch a movie about a sports writer. I know who's a really, really fun guy to bring up in casual conversation these days is Woody Allen. Woody Allen once made a movie where his main character was a sports writer, and the entire movie he just kept bribing people for information by giving them tickets. And I was like, okay, this is a guy that I, as a sports writer, I can watch this movie and be like, oh, this guy knows nothing about sports writing. This is not how this works at all. And so you definitely, like, when you're coming in from the outside, I tried to imagine not only the most knowledgeable SMA reader, but the least charitable.
Mm-hmm.
Like to go in with the idea that, like, quite reasonably, they would look at a 45-year-old white, able-bodied man and say, who are you to be able to write this character? And that is a completely justifiable question that I don't even think is necessarily unjustifiable to ask now. But what I can do is be aware of those questions and do everything I can to not just answer them, but, like, put the voices of the people who are answering them right there. In the book. And so you're never going to get it perfect because I didn't live it.
Right.
But certainly you do your best on it. And so far I feel like it has landed right for a lot of people, which is gratifying because I put a lot of work in to try to make it that way.
I also love the fact that so the book is set in Athens, where you live, Athens, Georgia, not Athens, Greece. Probably would have changed the book slightly.
Ohio.
Yes, right. Obviously, you live there, so you know the town, you know the culture. And I've actually only visited that one time when we got together with you at Rook and Pawn, which also appears in the book, which I appreciate. Rook and Pawn is a board game cafe in Athens, which I highly recommend if you're ever in that part of the country. But I love the fact that Athens becomes such a clear backdrop to the book. It's a bit of a cliche to say the place also became a character in the book. I don't know that that's quite true, but so much of Daniel's so much is explained about Daniel's character because he is involved in routines of the town, particularly game day, which also really enjoyed as somebody who's basically never experienced that, never lived in the South and did not go to college or even the place where I got my graduate degree. In none of those places was college football that big of a deal. And so I see it from afar and I think, that's cool. I wish I'd had something like some point in my life, right, that I had been involved in that. And to Daniel and Travis, especially, and even Marjani, which is kind of one of your more interesting things in the book, the more clever tweaks in the book, like they're very – game day is huge for them. And routine just becomes so much a part of the story in general. But I love the way that you work Athens and Athens life, college town life, small town life, university, big crazy SEC football life all becomes such a huge part of the book and then further illustrates things about Daniel's character.
Yeah, you know, it's fine. I've lived in Athens for about 8 years now, and I write about sports. I don't think I'm that bad at it, but, like, I had no idea what SEC football was really like until I was here. And so I was certainly not going to write a book. The book takes place in the span of 1 week, and I certainly wasn't going to write a book of something takes place in the span of 1 week in Athens, Georgia, and not have it be a game week.
Right, right.
It gives you
not April.
And also, like, Yeah, exactly. and as a natural, also, like, frankly, as a character who, frankly, spends most of his time at home and indoors, I need to get him out. I need to get him out doing stuff. I need to get him out seeing people, interacting with people. And so it's a good way to do that. But, you know, it's fine. The next book is actually also takes place in Athens. And I was talking to my agent, my editor about this. And he's like, I would love for this to be like a, not Stephen King main, but more like Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul universe, where everyone is all in the shared. There's actually a character that shows up in How Lucky Who, not Daniel, who shows up, who's going to be in the next book.
Oh, yeah, it's a little David Mitchell.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And I love that about Athens, because Athens, too, it's just a wild town because it's got so many different things. Like, I don't know if you know this, but Georgia has become like a big centerpiece of the political universe over the last couple of years.
I was unaware. And
I feel like Athens has been, I did not know that was going to happen when I moved here. it has really become like, I feel like Athens has so many contradictions, so many different kind of people. Well, you've got, like, obviously you've got a university town, but you also have, you know, you have, like, they, during the Black Lives Matter protest last year, there were Boogaloo boys coming in from towns 5 miles outside of Athens, all coming in. So you've got your good old boys, and you've got, Brian Kemp is from Athens. Like, you've got all these, but you also have, like, this not to say that Brian Kemp is a Boogaloo boy, by the way, just be very clear about that. But you have, you know, this incredible music scene. Like, I've almost hit Michael Stipe with my car several times in Athens. Thankfully, I have not done it. He just walks a lot, and he walks slowly.
Somehow.
Yeah. and so R.E.M. is like the music scene, like Drive By Truckers and the B-52s and Of Montreal and all these like incredible bands are based in Athens, and the music scene is incredible. But you also have, you know, you also still have, you know, the infrastructure of the state of Georgia, and you have histories of racial strife here, and you have history. Like, it's just it's such this rich place that is unclassifiable in so many ways. It gets so many different type of people. That was one of the appeals of having it be on a game day is everyone here is constantly, okay, what kind of person is this person I'm running into? I noticed this a lot during the pandemic of discovering, like, oh, how do I go back to the carpool line here now that I know that mom scowled at me for having a mask in the grocery store? And it's just stuff like that. Like, but there's also, you know, people that are, you know, there are people that are to the other extreme, in a lot of ways. It's a fascinating town. But the thing about football is, everybody comes together on football Saturdays. Right. like a couple years ago, there was, I wrote about this in the piece of Washington Post, when obviously the Kemp Abrams race was very heated and very intense. And, there was a tailgate where there was literally a Kemp tailgate and an Abrams tailgate, like across the street from another. I'm thinking, oh boy, this is the heat of it. It was really bad. And honestly, people were drinking together and talking by halfway through the day. And they were having disagreements, and but it was warm and mirthful and understanding and commiserating in a way that is difficult to find, but I think is important and matters. So, I'm hopeful that comes across in the book.
Yes, it did. It absolutely did. So the last thing I want to ask about, so my one very, very tiny contribution was you and I talked about Azul, which is one of my all-time favorite board games, and which makes an appearance in the book, that Daniel actually goes down to Rook and Pawn and plays somebody who just sits in Rook and Pawn every Tuesday, I think it is, in the book, and just plays sits down. Anyone who wants to play him in Azul, he plays them and then apparently dispenses with them extremely quickly. So what do you think of Azul, though? And I know you've played it a lot. You sent me that site where you were playing it online, which I also wasted a lot of time playing online, learned that I'm actually not that good at Azul after all.
Yeah, I can beat the computer, but occasionally. It's a fun game. The thing I like about Azul is it is, and originally Azul was a larger part of the book because it was setting up like a strategy sort of idea. The thing I like about Azul is when I play games, whether I'm coaching baseball or I'm playing basketball, whatever I'm doing, I have a tendency to just take care of myself. Like I'll play my game And if I play it well enough, I'll beat the other person. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Azul is you have to constantly be thinking about what the other person is doing.
Yep.
And that is a weakness of mine in gaming, because whatever I'm doing, because that's frankly the way I live my life. I'm not a particularly competitive person. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't really like look at other writers and be like, oh, well, they've sold more books than me, or they've got more Twitter. There's nothing wrong with people who do that. I just don't think of it that way. I don't look at traffic numbers. I just make the stuff and hopefully I get to keep making more stuff.
Right.
And so I just constitutionally just take care of myself. And so the reason I'm bad at Azul is that's not how you win in that game. You have to like constantly be thinking, what's this person? This is why I'm bad at a lot of these games.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those games where those strategy games where I figure I find the way. This is why I'd be a bad, baseball player. Because it's, obviously the physical.
I was going to say it's not because you're not 6'2" and right.
Right, right. But like, even if I had the abilities, I would, like, it's funny. I feel like I'm a smart person, but like when I played baseball, I was not a smart hitter. I was like, I was very Vlad Guerrero Sr. as a hitter. I was like, I see the
ball. Toast to nose, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just like, as I see the ball, let's hit it, let's go. And I figure I just take care of what I can do. And I would have not been the guy that was thinking, is he going to go with a slider with me on this? Which means the pitcher would constantly outsmart me.
Right.
Because I'm just taking care of my thing. And so for me, that was what was fun about writing about Azul. And that was why I picked the game Azul, even though that ended up becoming lesser of a factor, was because it was a game where you constantly have to think about what the other person is doing rather than what you're doing. And that was something I thought was really interesting kind of aspect of the game. But I'm bad at it, but I'm bad at most games. Nice.
One of the things I can do, what you're describing, if it's two players, whether it is a two-player game or simply me playing one other person, I can do that. I can look at you and try. I don't necessarily know what you're going to do, but at least I can keep track and think, well, you might do this or you might do that. There's a limited number of options, except for chess, which I'm horrible at because I can't do. There's just too. It's like 80, right. Yeah. There's just too many things. Right. It's an exponential. He knows two people and he knows two fields. Suddenly, there's 1,024 options for his next move, and I'm lost. But instead, in most board games like that, I can do that. I can keep one person. When I try to play 3-4 person games, I do them online sometimes. I generally don't do four people because I'm like, I just can't. What? There's just too much. I can't keep track of this.
Yeah,
right. And also, I'm like cooking dinner at the same time maybe recording a podcast, for example.
Yes.
So my guest today has been Will Leitch. You can find him on Twitter. It is William F. Leitch, L-E-I-T-C-H. But the most important thing to remember is Will's new novel, How Lucky, is out in hardcover from HarperCollins. You can get it at bookshop.org or anywhere you buy your books. Will, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for letting me be the second ever guest on the show. Yeah. I'm now, if you ever grab Grierson on again, I have to go on immediately afterwards.
Yes.
I have to just beat that.
Right,
guy.
To just be, yes. Well, if you get five times, you get a hat. We have like a five timers club.
That'll be very exciting.
Yes. Call me Mr. Will Leitch. That's all for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and please go get that vaccine.